The wrong side. That's true. But yeah, let's go all the way. I like it. We're live, basically. I mean, not live, but you know. That's. I'm not brave enough yet to live stream it. But that was one of the things you showed, was a live stream applet, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's basically doing the same thing that SAPstream is doing,
yep.
But just in an Oster applet.
Exactly. It's just pulling in the streaming events.
Yeah. So we should explain what applets are. We had the most successful workshop ever in the world today. A dozen people at least created applets.
Yeah.
And all this kind of stuff. And yeah, it's really fucking cool. So first of all, congrats on that.
Yeah, thanks.
For doing all that. And after we hit the party music, I think we'll just lean in and explain.
Yeah, sounds good.
But first of all, how did you come up with the idea for it? Like, what was the motivation behind building it up?
It's always been on my mind. When I saw early Noster, the clients weren't really that interesting to me. That's why I didn't really work on any. It seemed like the way that Noster is designed and architected, or the lack of it, it demands maximum flexibility, and no, like a standard client is very restrictive. It's and everything's isolated, which is the opposite of what the protocol is.
Restrictive in what way?
Well, because you have a team of people or a single developer building their one thing, and just to get it functional takes a lot of work, and all these people are working in the silo. And there's no way that even a large team could develop everything that you could possibly develop. So it just made sense to me that every functionality should be atomic. It should be switchable between one client and another. You should be able to compose your clients.
Mm, I see. So in terms of complexity, you mean taking care of the keys, taking care of the signing, taking care of the
relay connections,
taking care
everything.
Of
outbox.
Caching, taking care of outbox.
Yeah.
So all the things that... I mean, that's why we have a library layer now, basically. Like, we have NDK, we have applesauce, we have other things.
Yeah.
But your approach with the Noster applets is quite different. Like, it's on a different layer. How did you end up with this design decision, basically?
Well, it took some time to actually get to the point where I understood what I was thinking. Or what I was sort of envisioning when I was first got introduced.
What
to
was
Noster.
The first version? Like if it
the
took some
version,
time and
yeah.
It took some iterations, like what did you learn along the way and how did the first version
the
look
The first
like?
Version was at my friend's house in Sacramento. And I was getting into vibe coding a little bit. I think he was really into Claude, and he's like, you have to use Claude. So I was like, all right, I'll try Claude for
so
you.
So that was 1.5 years ago or so, something like that?
No, it was like, because I was using other things. He was really into Anthropic. I hadn't used Anthropic yet. It was in July, a year ago.
Okay,
a year ago. And I was sitting in his living room, and I was like, you know, like Insights had just come out, and I knew there was something there, that there's something special with Insights. And so I thought of, like, also I had recently gotten into the Hyperland compositor.
Oh, okay.
So yeah. It was, like, kind of inspired by that new fresh look at, like, what a desktop could be. And I built a prototype of what I showed you today.
How come you got into Hyperland? Is it where you always, like, a Wayland kind of guy? Or?
No, I mean... Well, wait. I don't want to get in the tribal fights between X11 and Wayland.
Why not? Why not?
No, it was more of just like, well, I should at least try it. So why I got into it was I was looking for a new desktop environment, and I didn't want a desktop environment. I was sick of the bloat. I was sick of the opinionation. I just wanted to build my own thing. You know, like...
sick of the opinionation, so I'm going to build my own opinionated thing.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. Well, other people's opinionation,
yeah, exactly.
Right? And, like, having to live through it. And, I just tested it out. I was just going to, you know, rice it up and see what it was about.
Yeah.
And...
So you were in that kind of mindset when you started hacking on what is now... applets.
Yeah, yeah. And I just saw like that when we were, well, I was making a lot of EnSites too. Like EnSites barely worked. And they, I was finding that I was spending a lot of time building a lot of things over and over and over and over, right? I think MakeStack was just around the corner, but even that, you have to maintain it after you've implemented it. So, yeah, I just built a prototype, and then I was like, wait, first of all, it's really hard to manage the memory in this because everything's in the main thread. And then I started breaking them into iframes. And at that point, I realized that in order to do it correctly, I would have to really step back from this prototype idea, this vision I have, and then actually figure out what it actually looks like to do this well. I found a lot of different security problems with my prototype and all this stuff. So
iframes, just hearing iframes. So
I know, it sounds so funny.
Yeah. Is it like...
It sounded funny to me too, yeah.
Did it work at all with iframes?
And yes, but it, but everything was, the lines were blurred. So because there was
the line between container and applet.
Yeah, because the applet could do whatever the runtime could do. And mm-hmm. so it could do things without the runtime knowing, without the user knowing, and it mm-hmm. couldn't be possible to sort of restrict what the app was doing, right? Mm-hmm. At this time, it was actually called Naps.
Okay.
Yeah, which okay. is kind of funny.
Yeah. which is fitting. Apps can do more than applets.
Yeah, yeah. So I moved into a Tori app. EnSite.run actually. Or no, it was nap.run. And I built that pretty quick, but it hit the ceiling really quickly as well because there's a bunch of stuff I couldn't do. And then I immediately went into forking Thorium, which is like a slimmed down Chromium, but the build chain for that was insane. It took a huge amount of space to run the CI, and I just was like, I can't do this right now. So I stepped back further, and I just started with a single frame, and I started attacking the runtime from inside of the iframe. And progressively, I removed more and more and more features of what the iframe was allowed to do until it got to the point where it could basically do nothing except for talk over post message.
Okay.
And I wasn't very hopeful. I didn't think it would work because I found myself redefining Noster inside of the sub protocol that it is now become. And it took a few months, like 4 or 5, 6 months, before I understood that I was approaching it entirely wrong. And I identified that the person making the application doesn't need to know as much as I originally thought. Like, they don't need to know that they're uploading to Blossom. They don't mm-hmm. need to know where they're uploading.
They don't need to know about relays. They don't need to know about
They need
KC,
to know a little
right?
bit. They need to understand that there are relays. Mm-hmm. And so once I got the security posture where it was, and I played with the API enough, I realized there was really two sets of API services that the Naplet should have, which is sort of like a high-level helper kind of style API, and then escape hatches, so that flexibility isn't compromised. Because if you try to do everything through helpers, you sort of constrain the potential experiences that you could create.
What's an escape hatch in that context?
Outbox would be the easiest way to retrieve notes because you basically delegate the outbox context to the runtime. But the escape hatch is a relay interface that allows you to have a lower level access to the protocol if you need it.
Okay, okay, okay. So in case something doesn't work right, you use the escape hatch and try to do things more
exactly.
directly.
Okay, exactly.
I get it. I see.
The next challenge was getting naplets to talk to one another. That was very difficult. Actually, we only settled on it last night, how to fix that.
Who is we?
Hazard and I.
Okay.
We were talking about it.
This goddamn Hazard, he has his fingers in everything.
Yeah, it took me a while to get him on board.
Yeah, you mentioned that briefly today. You tried to explain it to him for multiple weeks or months or something.
A year, almost a year.
and then you showed it to him and he was hooked in like 10 minutes or something.
Yeah, yeah. He got it immediately. And I found that, like, trying to explain the paradigm is a lot more difficult than just showing it.
And you built this awesome workshop tutorial page that I was able to point my agent to, and just everything worked basically. I was able to build the first applet in 5 minutes or so.
Yeah,
something
it was like
that.
5 or 6 minutes, yeah, and deployed in 6 minutes.
Yeah, yeah, so if someone's curious, I'll definitely link that, and then you can
I'm gonna make some improvements to it because some people had some issues.
Yeah, but, I mean, you have to understand what's going on the underlying side, and it helps to have a proper setup. You know, like I was lucky that I have Amber on my phone and can set up the signing for the publication flow and all this kind of stuff. And I have, you know, like also a proper Nostr setup and a proper signing setup on my laptop, on my development machine.
Oh, yeah.
And so on. That,
yeah,
that makes everything easier. But if you have that, if you do a little bit of prep work, then pointing an agent at this tutorial will just work.
Yep.
So that's awesome.
That was the idea.
Yeah.
And fortunately too, it's not like a lot of this, while everything is agent assisted, there's a lot of experience that went into it. Like, it wasn't designed by AI. If it was designed by AI, I don't think it would work.
It's amazing how well it works, by the way.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So
it's surprising
kind of
to me too.
But talk to me more about kind of the level of abstraction that you landed on, iterating on it for like almost a year. Because it's, you also mentioned briefly, Fiat Jeff kind of hates it in the sense that it doesn't use kinds as a messaging bus and so on.
Yeah, yeah.
So you chose a different level of abstraction. So explain that some more.
Well, I wouldn't say he hates it, because it inspired him when I showed him an early demonstration. I just sent him a screenshot and said, this can open that. And he was like, well, that would be a paradigm change. And it did inspire him to actually revisit one of his old projects that was very similar to this. But some of the design decisions I've made, he has been disagreeing with quite a bit.
I mean, to be fair, Fiat Jeff basically hates everything on first sight. So,
of course.
You know,
yeah,
that's just how it goes.
That's just how it goes. Yeah.
It's almost like a stamp of approval.
Almost, yeah. Yeah, actually, you're probably right.
Because, you know, like, if he wouldn't say he hates it, then he would just be indifferent to it and wouldn't say anything.
Exactly, yeah. it took a lot of different iterations. I mean, it started with the shell, which is what mediates every request from, like, over the bus, right? Being a relay. And then the NAPLETs were sending Nostr messages using NIP1, and then I was going to extend new messages, but this created a bunch of a huge convoluted mess, because you had to arbitrarily assign a key pair from the runtime to the NAPLET, right? And this was just completely unnecessary, because the runtime already had full control over the NAPLET already, so it doesn't need it to confirm it.
Mm. I see.
And then otherwise, then you'd be sending unsigned events, which then was weird, because you did want to know sort of where the events were when they were being routed. One of the benefits the first design had was that you could tell where the event came from at any point in the runtime. You could always tell, oh, it came from this NAPLET.
But every NAPLET had a key as well, or that's something you mentioned, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like, yeah. Yeah. So it did simplify certain things, but it made pretty much everything else complicated.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then I think I figured out, so there was an aha moment when I did resource, because trying to load, like, it created a unique problem where you want to load bytes, but you can't fetch them because the NAPLET doesn't have any access to the network. And you have to stream the bytes over the bus. And then I'm like, okay, so how do I do YouTube videos? How do I do streams? And then it clicked because this is the same problem that operating systems face. And they have a media API. And so I just basically copied Linux. And it worked like pretty much first try. And when that happened, I just realized I didn't have to reinvent anything. And then
have to rebuild an operating system in a browser window, basically.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, and you didn't even see all of it.
So walk me through what happens if you used the example before, uploading something to a Blossom server. Yeah. Let's say we have an applet, very simple drag and drop upload to the user's Blossom servers, and then, you know, like, let's do the same for download. Like, what happens on the applet shell level, like on the container level?
So the applet would just, you'd probably have a drop zone. Maybe it would have a listener for paste and an upload button. Obviously, you'd upload the image, it would be in memory, and then you would
That today, by the way, right? Like, you right click copied an image and you went to another applet and then you just pasted it and they did an upload.
So
the paste will, of course, you know, drop the bytes, stream the bytes into the thing.
And how
does it work? Like, how does it figure out, like, which Blossom server to upload and, like, all those kind of
things? Absolutely. So it actually, the interface is just upload. And then the runtime is what decides what that means. And it's the runtime's target market also decides what that means. So you could have a runtime that supports, say, Blossom, Hashtree, let's say IPFS, just for fun. And maybe, like, let's just even say Google Drive. Like, I would never do it, but you could, right? And the user has none configured, and they initiate an upload. The runtime detects, hey, you know, I support these things, but none of them are configured. You do not have a server list for Blossom. It would then prompt them to configure it. If they did have one of them already configured, it would, if they had one, maybe it would just automatically upload it to that source. Or if they had maybe two configured, it would ask if they wanted to upload to one or the other or both. Now on read, you would just pass the Blossom hash or whatever the resource is. So the resource, because the runtime's mediating everything, it knows where it's uploading. And so when you pass a resource, it knows where to look.
Yeah.
Because the runtime is mediating everything. There are obviously some gaps here. So for example, if you have notes on Noster that are IPFS and the runtime doesn't support IPFS, then it won't work, right? Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of gaps like that. And there is ways to deal with that. You could just detect that in the applet, like when a resource isn't returned, you could do something so that it's not a bad user experience. But yeah, that's a pretty straightforward solution. There are
some bookends. And in terms of signing events and all those kind of things, like, how does it work? Like, you have what kind of interface do you have, and how does the app itself that contains the applet kind of
the host, like, yeah, the runtime, yeah,
the,
yeah,
the host.
We could call it a host application. Yeah. People resonate with that.
And just to maybe mention that, like you mentioned, Amethyst already supports.
An earlier version.
Applets.
Yeah.
And Nostrudel also supports it.
Yep.
And so, like, this is already working right now, and then you have like a little applet thing, whatever, in your Nostr client, in your Nostr environment, and the signing, and like you said, like, the what is my Blossom server list, for example, this is all handled by the host application.
Yeah.
And so how does this get triggered and passed on? And let's say, you know, like, you just want to post an event, or even for a Blossom upload, you have to sign something. Like, what happens there?
So the signature always occurs in by the shell. So beyond the shell, we could call it, we'll just use the word host. I prefer runtime for technical reasons, but I think host makes the most sense for people who are being introduced to it. So the host application for the applets is responsible for all encryption, decryption, and over the shell is always clear text. So if it receives encrypted text over the shell, it must reject it. That's part of the rule. If you're publishing, you're doing a publish, or you can do publish encrypted. And if you're decrypting, you can just do decrypt.
on explain the, that some more with the one rule you just mentioned, that over the shell it's always plain text. I don't think I understand.
So there's a number of attacks that you can do, because the in order for this to work, NAPLETs have to be safe to use even when they're malicious. So like the user can't have to second guess the NAPLET, otherwise it will never work. There's a number of side channel attacks. So for example, you can do a sort of storage of decrypted data, encrypted data. And then you could also do like heuristics in the NAPLET and store stuff in storage scopes, and then send it in an encrypted message back to yourself as the NAPLET author. So everything is required to be plain text over the message bus.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
That way the runtime can tell the user what the NAPLET is doing. It can log it appropriately.
Yeah. And the user can be sure, have a reasonable assurance that no funny business is going on. Because you can inspect everything that goes back and forth.
Exactly.
Yeah, I see. Okay.
And the runtime cannot protect the user from something it doesn't know about.
Yeah.
So that's really important.
Yeah. Okay. I see. Yeah, fancy stuff. So there's quite a bit of thought.
Yeah.
Quite a bit of thought went into that.
Oh yeah. A lot of testing.
How did you build it out in terms of you have quite a sophisticated development setup and those kind of things, and some ideas around how to use agents properly. Like what did you use to build out the whole applet engine and everything?
I think both. Well, I went through phases, and I may have done a rewrite. I did a rewrite on NAPLET, on the NAPLET dev tooling. And when I redid the rewrite, I used GSD. And same with Keto, which is the runtime packages.
So GSD is Get Shit Done?
Yeah, or it was. They had to rebrand.
Yeah. Let's stick with Get Shit Done. Good name.
Yeah.
And Keto, you mentioned?
Yeah. It's like, the name, it's actually Finnish, and there's actually no real reason for that. I was just looking for five-letter words that hadn't been used on any project.
Okay.
And it was the only one that, when translated, made sense. It's Finnish for crib, or cradle.
Okay.
Which kind of made sense, because it sort of, you know, cradles NAPLETs. It protects... the user is the baby.
Yeah.
And then the development runtime is Paya, which I just learned how to pronounce it today from my roommate. And that is Workbench.
Okay.
In Finnish as well. That is can be used to build runtimes. So that includes a shell, an ACL, a firewall, which really only behaves like a rate limiter right now to relieve pressure from the runtime. It includes services, stubs for services like notifications, relay pools, storage, KV storage, media handler, and a few other things. The NAPLET dev tooling is about conformance. It has the shim, which might actually be moved to Keto because it's injected by Keto. It includes a SDK, some types, a boilerplate, and skills, and a few others. These are pretty tightly, like, the architecture of these was pretty heavily considered because first of all, there's no dependencies in any of them. They're lightweight. By using them...
No dependencies on any other Gnosis stuff? Or what do you mean by no dependencies?
Like, it's vanilla JavaScript, except for maybe, like, the skills and the dev tooling, like the bundlers and stuff. But other than that, it is without dependencies. Yeah.
They're celebrating the launch of many, many NAPLETs today. That's quite something. No dependencies. Yeah. Like that's a very pure approach.
Well, it's intentional too. It's Because
was it security considerations?
Yeah, it was.
Okay.
And also just simplicity of maintenance. Because you don't need these packages. I mean, you could just, there's a protocol, right?
Like it's, yeah.
So you could build all of this without any of the packages for sure. It would be really hard to sell anyone on it in 2026, but yeah, you could do it without any of the packages and create a runtime and Naplets without using my packages.
Yeah, yeah, I see.
One of the interesting things about it is Naplets are single file. So every Naplet is one file. And an applet is a application that does one thing really well and is served by a host application as opposed to being like a standalone application. And by making it a single file, you sort of implicitly force people to sort of conform to that philosophy.
Yeah. It has to be small.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's quite interesting also to look at because widgets were a big thing. In a different era, like operating like OS level widgets, mm-hmm. both on the like any operating system, basically, like on the Linux side, on the Windows side, it was a big thing where just you have your desktop and you have all these widgets that you can compose and so on. And
yeah.
Like even, like in the early kind of Web 2.0 days, there were also some landing pages that were insanely widget heavy. And so it's kind of cool and kind of interesting to see this emerge on Nostr. And before we go deeper into the basically operating system you've built for it, and you mentioned also that there are some competing projects or projects that had the same idea. VHF had one of them.
Yeah.
Like talk me through. The other projects that tried to do this and I
some of them are still going.
Yeah. But just in kind of as a comparison and just that, not everyone knows all this stuff. And as you know, I philosophically, I was always a big believer and a fan of Hypernote, Paul came up with.
Oh yeah.
And it's very similar in style in some sense. Very different execution, but
yeah.
But very similar like spiritually.
Yeah.
So talk me through kind of the other projects that have been trying to do similar things.
So I think if I do it in order, I guess it would be Fiat Jaffs, which I really don't know much about. He started it before the whole Jax wave things in the late 2022, right? So I've only been working on Nostr.
Ancient idea.
Yes, ancient
idea.
And I think probably too early,
for
that kind of idea. But clearly this was in his head. The next one that I'm aware of, because there could be others, didn't Yaki Hone have something like a view or something?
Potentially.
Yes, they had something.
I'm not a Yaki Hone power user, so I wouldn't know.
Yeah, but I believe they had something similar, but it was very... it's very simple, which isn't a bad thing. And then I believe Soapbox has Tiles, which is slightly different. It's made for native. It's Lua-based, which is cool.
Hmm.
I've been talking to that guy a lot, and it's a really cool project. Balash and Fiat Jaff have been... my project's a little bit inspired Fiat Jaff to revisit his original idea. So he's working with Balash. They're working on Nostr apps or NAPs.
So that's called Nostr apps,
yeah.
The project.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I have to look it up later and link to it.
That one is good. It reminds me, if I look at the commit history, it basically looks like my thinking from about a year ago. So
interesting. Let's see where it goes.
They're kind of solving problems in a similar order, and maybe they'll come to a different conclusion.
Yeah.
That would be interesting. There's a lot of unique problems to solve, like you used the operating system briefly. It was pretty fast, right?
Yeah
it's fast.
It was surprisingly fast and worked, and also surprisingly intuitive and it also looks very good. Like I like that style of window management.
Yeah, me too.
And doing things. So,
so a lot of that is because of how it's designed. It's the security posture. It's the fact that they don't have web APIs. And it's also that, the main thread is kept really, it's solely reserved for rendering the dome in the parent frame and routing messages. Pretty much everything else occurs in WebWorkers.
I see.
And with without that CSP and sandboxing iframes, it's pretty much impossible to do that. You could just have a Naplet start calling every relay on Noster and then no other Naplet works and then the parent frame crashes.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Right. And there's no way for the parent frame to regulate the pressure of each Naplet and control it. But so that's the primary difference between some of the other existing projects and Naplets as it is right now. Maybe that will change. But that's actually the only difference right now between Noster apps and Naplets.
Okay.
They have different APIs and they have a different philosophy as well.
What made you choose the browser as an environment to build all that stuff out as opposed to just doing a native desktop app or whatever? Right. Because as you mentioned, the Naplet system is a protocol specification. Like, there's no need to do all this in the browser. You can write native code, whatever. Like, you can use Swift and build an applet browser for iOS and just do everything natively. So what made you do it in the browser, kind of? Because the OS you showed off just works in the browser, basically.
Yeah.
Which it's awesome. It felt kind of magical to use it. And if you go full screen, you wouldn't even notice if you're in the browser.
Exactly. Yeah. So a few reasons. So the first one is practical and also more like release strategy. The user doesn't have to install anything. So you can give someone a link and they can use it in seconds. They don't have to, like even anonymous user, you know, the onboarding could include just an anonymous user. You browse as Jack and you're in, right?
Yeah. And just to give people an idea, that might be a good, lots of people maybe know the Synology interface for Synology NAS devices, and they basically have their own OS, their own window manager and so on, and it all runs in the browser as well, and you can, you know, drag your windows around you know, like right-click on stuff and the context window will pop up and so on. And so very similar to what you've built in from the kind of, just to give people an idea of, like, how it looks and feels, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So the other reason too is that it's sort of permissionless, because the runtime doesn't have any gateways like Ensight. The runtime resolves everything and does all the blob hash validation, and so everything.
Oh, that's an interesting thing that I didn't think about yet. Okay.
It can be deployed as an Ensight.
Yeah. The shell basically runs locally, and the bits and pieces are collected from whatever, like relays, Blossom servers, IPFS, torrent, whatever. Like,
exactly.
That's very interesting. Yeah.
And
don't need an initial delivery in some sense.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And I see it. And so it's not the furthest edge. Like, I guess the furthest edge would be some microcontroller or something with like a screen and like.
Yeah, sure.
Like
a shell literally acts like an operating system.
Yeah.
And you can boot it up, and if let's say you're offline and it's just empty, you just can't get stuff from outside, but it still works.
Exactly.
That's how it's,
Yeah, that's how it's...
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. That's a beautiful bug.
This one?
Yeah. There's a lot of them on the island.
Yeah, that's very old bugs. Yeah. No need to fix this one.
Nope. So it also sort of proves something. So it's on an edge that you think this wouldn't work in. So if it can work on this edge, and then you push it all the way to another edge, and you can get it the protocol to work on that edge that's not web, then theoretically it should work everywhere in between, right?
Okay.
So
yeah,
the thinking was, I do it in the browser, which should be impossible. Then the next logical step is a browser or a native app. Now, next logical step is a native app, then a browser, then an operating system, and then
By browser, you mean an applet explorer. Let's walk up here. We will be a little bit, you know, sweating and
winded,
huffing and puffing, but it's worth it. It's a good spot.
The next step after that would probably be like a custom kernel, like a micro kernel, like a CyberDeck type thing, which is really where we should be heading. A lot of the hardware is, you know, very well guarded by the people who own them and like produce these, the hardware we take for granted every day. So by, So I produced a RISC-V microkernel that implemented some of the basic interfaces of NIP5D.
I didn't realize it was NAPLET related. I thought it was a completely different project.
And I just implemented it to see if there was any like hiccups in something in a completely different environment. The harder ones, like resource, outbox, and I implemented KV storage, and one other one that's not coming to me right now. And I was able to get that working with the 2E that was in a moderately sandboxed environment. And once I could see that working, in theory, I went full force on the website just to get it to the public.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, no, it looks and feels really, really well. And yeah, it was kind of magical to see all the, like, I don't know, the hit rate was probably 2/3 or so of the cohort managed to create an applet.
More. the whole cohort. Yeah. 2/3
of the people that were at the workshop, it was probably like 80%, and you could just load these applets in your OS and it would just pop up and would just work.
You could load it in Ostrudel, it would work.
Yeah.
Paya, it might work. There was a bug there.
Amethyst.
Yeah, Amethyst.
Still, yeah, I still don't really know how to load them properly or how to view them all, but you know, we had some successes.
Yeah, there were some. The more simple ones loaded. He hasn't chased the spec. I don't blame him.
Yeah, you mentioned it's still evolving, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'll probably have to open some PRs, or it would even be better if someone from the cowork, you know, from the cohort, opened an issue and everyone else put some thumbs up on it.
We can DDoS Amethyst, no problem.
Yeah.
All right. That's the turnaround point. It's nice though, right? You've been here before, right?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah, it looks familiar. That's,
my explicit goal, you see the dancing lights up there? The green and blue lights, there seems to be a party. That's a really nice house with like a glass glass window front, and it's right on top of the cliff and it goes straight down.
My
goal in Madeira is to get to know the guy and just, you know, have coffee there and look down. That's one of my goals why I'm here. I want to know who owns this
place and just
come swing by for a coffee one day and look straight down like 300 meters or something. Like, it's an insane cliff. And the building goes like right over the cliff. Like, it's literally, if you're in front of the glass, like it will feel like you're floating.
Is it like that bar in, was it Ponte do Sol?
I don't think so.
Yeah, there's like a bar and it's right over the cliff when you come into the city and then you turn right before you hit this tunnel. There's this bar on the cliff.
All right, I'll have to check that out.
Yeah. It's a really pretty.
That's good. Yeah, good place. All right, so we have you have the basically OS in the browser.
Yeah.
In pretty good shape, I would say.
Yeah,
What's still missing? Like, what are the bits and pieces that you still want to implement?
You know, some polish, the onboarding. There's still some bugs.
You mentioned notifications, and you mentioned
notifications are not done. Yeah.
Inter-applet communication. Tell me a little bit about that. Like, how are you thinking about like one applet spawning an action or spawning something in another applet?
It's a scheme, so it's like NAPLET: archetype/intent parameters.
So that's similar to, like, you open a deep link and an app pops up on Android or iOS,
yes.
And it does, like, I don't know, like, everyone kind of knows this, if you, I don't know, like, you have a video or whatever, and you go, like, share as a new post on Amethyst, and then it will pop up and do the thing, and so
yeah.
on. So a similar idea.
Yeah.
Like, how the, like, intents and all those kind of things is how this works as well.
Yeah, because I found that the semantics of data alone...
You know what?
Really
let's get the let's go the other way. Then we
yeah,
have
sure.
a little bit of a loop going. We don't go the same direction. I'm just saying the switcheroo. All right. So polish, and then you mentioned the next step would be
so the inter-applet communication,
yeah.
right?
Oh yeah. Sorry. it's very late. You know, it was a long day.
I got to keep you on track. So yes, it's similar to Android and many operating systems. The semantics of the data were too constraining. So the way they're defined, so this is very experimental. This could very well not work at all. But the way we're thinking of it is that if you're going to open a profile, you're probably going to pass an npub or an mprofile.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't think that the developer that makes the app that talks to profile needs any specification to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We are kind of betting that people can sort of figure it out.
Okay.
Because it's implicit. It's like, what else are you going to pass to a profile intent or mm-hmm. archetype, right? If it's like profile slash open, then you're going to be passing an npub, an mprofile, maybe a hex,
mm-hmm.
if you're mean.
Maybe an IPO5.
Yeah. And yeah, exactly. And we like we're gonna like specify this in a repo somewhere. I really don't think so. There's probably, if this is successful, there will be hundreds of thousands of potential like wire formats. And we think we're gonna try to figure that out later because that is way too much overhead at this point
mm-hmm.
to try to design some system to manage these messages that we don't even know if this will exist. So right now they're ad hoc. So far it's working. Balash made a profile in applet today and it worked. It opened the feed, I believe.
Yeah. I think at the point where we are at, the most important thing kind of is, can your agent make sense of it? It's less than like, is everything perfectly specified or
exactly.
whatever, like for humans, it's just like, is it in a state so that it makes sense to the LLM?
Yeah, exactly.
So there's
something magical about two developers being in two different locations, never talking and just sort of being like, hey, we agree it works.
Mm-hmm.
Or like developer A just figuring it out. Like he's mm-hmm. using developer B's applet and he's like, how do I talk to this? Figures it out. And then he's just like, I'm going to use that. That makes sense.
Yeah.
I don't think we need to specify everything.
Yeah, I think in the LLM world, in the agent world, over-specification is sometimes
can be
a burden.
Yeah.
So under-specifying oftentimes you see, just works better.
Mm-hmm.
they'll figure it out.
Yeah.
Okay. So, that's cool. So that's next as well, right? Like you said, you're still working on that and... The inter-applet communication like isn't where it needs to be yet.
No.
Okay.
No, it's experimental. We'll see what happens.
And after that, you mentioned probably a desktop shell.
Yep.
After that, the more esoteric things that you just went through before. So, how can we best help? If someone is excited about this, what's the best way to contribute and test it out and help you move things along?
Well, I mean, the dev tooling needs polish, needs work. Use cases need to be explored and questions need to be asked and answered. There is a danger in that, though, because it is a little bit jarring for most Nostr developers to understand where the boundary of the shell, like the seam between the shell and the applet is. And so there's this tendency.
So it might be better if you come in fresh?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
So like a Nostr developer or anyone with a client can implement a runtime like right now. It's just a translation layer between the shell and their existing business logic.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take Hazard to implement the shell in Nostro?
I think it was working really fast, like you know, kind of working in a few hours to a day. I think he still has work to do on it, but and it doesn't have that many capabilities yet. But I think it was like 2 days or 3 days until stable, but I don't want to speak for him.
Yeah, yeah. No, but that's awesome. It's at least it's not weeks, you know?
No, I think Vitor really did it in like a day.
Yeah, yeah.
But he also had a very limited subset of capabilities.
Yeah.
Any developer can make Naplets because they have very little Nostr domain knowledge requirements. So you don't need to... Like, they don't need to think about anything.
you don't need to, like, deeply understand how Nostr works and need to know all the kinds and need to know all the, you know, intricate details of how the WebSocket connections work and, like, all this kind of stuff, right? Like, that's the main benefit. You can just do stuff.
Yeah.
More easily.
You can just build things. Yeah.
Yeah, that's
and
awesome.
You leave the security and the optimization to the runtime people.
Awesome, awesome.
Another cool opportunity is runtimes because... I showed you like a pretty powerful runtime, but they don't all have to be like that. And they can be many different things.
So what you're saying is a runtime can be very slim.
Oh, yeah.
And very minimal.
It could also have nothing to do with social. So I have a game from Sec 1. It was PubKey Land, but I changed it to NPub Land for obvious reasons. And that uses Naplets. That's a runtime, and you can use Naplets as a mod system for the game,
okay.
Permissionless.
Huh. Interesting.
So in that context, you can like place items on the user's land, and then when they go near it, you know, it pops up a Naplet. And that could be one of many things.
Okay.
Then there's also global Naplets. So you could have like a radio station playing. From like your own radio.
Yeah, yeah, that's awesome.
Right. So small. That's like a really small example. Another thing would be something nothing related to social at all, or like very loosely related, like music collaboration or video editing collaboration. That's all possible as well.
Yeah.
You could have plugin systems. You could use Naplets as a plugin for that application. And it doesn't necessarily need to be social. Social Naplets at all. It could be very limited capabilities.
Yeah, it doesn't need to make use of the social aspect of Nostr.
Yeah, you could just have the identities for the purpose of like sessions.
Yeah.
Basically.
I see. I see. I mean, one of the demos we saw today is the paint Naplet that Hazard, I think, built, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so you literally have like an MS Paint style mini app as a Naplet. And like, yeah, you can just load that everywhere and just do your thing.
Yeah, you can load that in any client and, you know, it could be used for whatever. Like, you could mark up images. A client could say, okay, cool, I don't know if it has this capability right now, but you could say, hey, load the image into here and then from somewhere else.
Yeah.
Mark it up and then post it as a comment.
It's a very interesting way of, like, decomposing... Like, let's take Amethyst as the kitchen sink everything client.
Yeah.
Like, no offense to Vitor, but everyone knows that it's just like, whatever is out there, Vitor will put into Amethyst.
That's a good thing. The sandbox. Yeah, it's fun.
And so kind of the with the Naplet line of thinking, it's basically almost every feature of Amethyst or every screen in some sense and those kind of things. Can be done as an applet and can then be recomposed in one of the shells. Like, again, like it looks and feels like an operating system, and it just like pull out these widgets and place them where you want to have them, or like arrange them however you see fit. And they're very loosely coupled. Like the paint application we just mentioned that we saw today, like you paint the picture, whatever, like paint or annotate something and so on. And then it's literally like right click. Copy image, and then you go to your like whatever send tweet, send post kind of thing, or to your long form applet, and you just paste it, And, you know, we're back in the good old days where everything is very simple.
Yeah.
So that's really cool.
It's really exciting. It's fun to see what people come up with, too.
Yeah, it's amazing how well it works. Like, I was blown away today how well it works and how fast everything is. And kind of, again, like, just deploying an app plant, it's basically you have this one file and you sign it and you push it to a relay and then it's just out there. And you just, like, I basically created a mini app in like 5 minutes on my machine, pushed it out, like published it to nowhere. Like you compared it to SAP Store as well, right? Yeah, like with SAP Store as well, where you just push it to your relays, it's out there, and your operating system basically immediately saw it. You immediately drag and drop the thing onto your desktop, and it was there. Yeah. And it's
amazing.
Yeah,
it really is.
It was fantastic to see like how well it works and how everything plays together.
And how many different Naplets came out too. Almost everyone produced a Naplet.
Yeah. There
was a chess game that works, multiplayer.
Yeah.
Although you can make, as the player, you can make both moves.
Yeah, caveat emptor, you know, like absolutely everything is alpha, including the Naplets.
Yeah, of course. And then it's also nice to see it like go into that exact same Naplet, go into another runtime, and it does the exact same thing.
Yeah, really cool. Yeah, awesome. And so you got sidetracked by that basically, and the whole Naplet idea swallowed you whole the last 12 months or so?
Ish, well, I wasn't working full time on it.
Yeah.
I didn't have the energy or resources.
Because you've been involved in quite some projects, you know, like lots of stuff on the relay side and those kind of things. You mentioned you had this idea very early on. Was it helpful to like talk to me a little bit about the Nosta journey you went through in terms of development? Because pre-Naplets, I feel like you occupied yourself with very different ideas. You know,
I mean, you could say that. It actually all builds up to this, if you look at it, right? So, and also I want to sort of correct previous statement. I didn't have an exact idea of this, but it was like a feeling that I didn't really have words for. And I just knew that it was on the horizon, but I also knew it couldn't be done right then. Like when I first found Nostr. I mean, my journey started because I was on a self-funded sabbatical and in 2022, and I was kind of miserable and
many such cases.
Yeah. And I was getting off of it and I was like, okay, what am I going to do? Am I going to go get a contract? Am I going to get a job? And I was like, no, I'm going to like play around a little bit. I'm tired of that scene. And so I launched the Lightning node and I was playing around with various open source software. I think it was LNDG, and then there was an input for a Nostr notification, and I'm like, what the hell is Nostr? This must be related to Bitcoin. And then I clicked on it. The repo was already starred. Friend of mine later reminded me that we ran into it in 2020 when all the censorship stuff was going on, but it was just like a repo. And then we were actually looking for something to use. We weren't looking for something to build at the time, but I had started, I was looking around. I started playing with Astral Ninja. I saw that it had activity, you know, maybe like the same 10 people over and over.
Yeah.
And then I kind of just wanted to learn more because it seemed very interesting the way that it was laid out. I read NIP 1 and it kind of immediately something happened in my head and it just felt like an explosion. Like, I don't know. It's hard to explain. Like the whole mind blown.
It immediately made sense.
Yeah. Basically. Like in a weird way.
Yeah.
And not everything made sense perfectly, but something very deep, lured me in.
Yeah. Let's have a sip of water before we collapse and also get a bit
of that would be a good idea.
To those.
Yeah,
you know, usually after an hour, it's like your brain needs a little bit of water.
And like very little sleep as well.
Yeah.
On a hot day.
It was a long, long day.
It was a long day, yeah.
There you go.
Yeah,
and it's very late. It's you know, we'll
Oh, come on. 10:17. I've had later nights.
Yeah, no. But I, you know, like I'm an old man. I go to sleep with the kids usually. This is 2 hours past my bedtime. All right. Yeah, have some more before, like, you know. Stay hydrated. Where's my
hydro? I could lower my heartbeat a little bit. So I was looking for something to do because the I was just curious. Okay, what relays are out there? And then there was Noster Relay Registry. I think it was Fiat Jaffs, maybe not. I don't remember. But I forked it, and then I was just. Also, the other thing is that I hadn't been working as a low level developer for many years. Like I'm a developer, but I was doing higher level things. Mm-hmm. And so I also sort of wanted to sort of reacclimate to. Mm-hmm. To development, and also it had been even longer since I was doing front end development. Mm. So, picking up a fork of Noster Relay Registry, which was sort of hurting and barely worked,
and that became Noster Watch.
And then, like, I got sick, I got the flu, and I remember I was on my couch I was like bedridden for 3 days, and my phone just kept vibrating, like over and over for hours, and eventually I could like look at the phone because, you know, I was very light sensitive at the time with the flu, and I'm like, it was like 50 pull requests, and I'm like, what the fuck? So I like go and I'm like, okay, people are adding relays. I'm like, wow, that's a lot of relays. Like this, there was, I think, 6 relays online when I started the thing, and it took me about a day to figure out that Jack had posted it, and then other people were sending people there to add their relays so that other people could find it. Mm-hmm. That became a whole thing. That's a mess. But I mean, it's the thing is,
so I still use Noster.
I know. A lot of people do. It took a lot out of me, and a lot of things happened too, like that year in 2023. And it was just a pretty hard year. So
yeah,
a lot of those memories are tied in with that sort of experience.
Having a side project that kind of
like sucks
know,
it out. Like you're just being basically insulted every day.
It's not always good. Not every face of your life is side project friendly.
Exactly. Exactly. It's really stable now. I never touch it. I mean, there was a cross-site scripting attack a couple weeks ago and I had to do an update, but other than that, it runs itself. It's very cheap. It's fast-ish. I mean, the client kind of sucks, but the infrastructure is solid.
I still use it. I use it all the time, mostly to find like NIP50 relays and just kind of health check my own stuff and all kinds of things. Like I think it's very, very useful. Yeah. So thanks for building that as well. Yeah. That's great.
Appreciate it. Yeah. I think I've gotten more thanks recently for it, but up until a few, maybe like 6 months ago, it was definitely, I got more crap for it than thanks.
I mean, that's always kind of disproportional, unfortunately, on the internet. Like, it's if something annoys you, it's very easy to scream at the guy and like whatever, and shit on stuff. And most of the people that are super happy with things are just silent. Like, there's a silent majority that's just, you won't hear from. That's just how it goes. But yeah, you ran into Ensight early on as well, and you built Ensight.run as well.
Yep. Well, so, both Ensight.runs.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, and Ensight is such a weird project.
It is.
Because, you know, the guy, when was it? Was it the second cohort? Right?
Yeah, Sec 2.
And like the original author of Ensight, like, didn't really understand what he had with Ensight.
Yeah.
And so other people had to pick up the pieces and move it forward. And you were one of them, and Hazard was one of them as well.
Hazard was the big piece of it. Yeah, he took over the spec.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so now it's definitely a thing. And, like, you know, half the demos we see, and like, from SCC 03, 04 onward, like, half the demos were deployed as Ensights, and that's quite something.
That's really great to see. Yeah.
So what made you excited about Ensight? What made you build Ensight.run and all that?
Actually,
this stuff?
Nothing to do with Ensight. To be honest, the first, I didn't have high hopes for Ensight. I mean, obviously it's interesting to me. The reason why I did it is because I really love CLI interfaces and TUIs, and I wanted to build a TUI, and I couldn't, and Florian did a great job at doing the first the first CLI for Insight, but I really, I like automation, and I didn't want to put my private key in some secrets field on some random website. So I needed NIP46, and so I needed a more sophisticated key management system. And I was like, I want to build a, I haven't built a beautiful CLI in over a decade. So I like, that's the main reason I did it.
That's awesome.
And I didn't expect that when I released it, that was the first time that a lot of people knew it existed.
Yeah.
And then that kicked off people launching gateways and making their own CLIs and all this stuff, right? And people tried to use it. The first version didn't work very well. So I started the other Insight, the Insight with the that's spelled correctly, .runs, to sort of coalesce people around the specification.
Yeah.
And then over the next year, I think it was, Hazard slowly developed the specification, identified things that were wrong. I think at one point he was willing to give up on it, but he pushed forward, and he pushed a new spec. I believe it was December of 2025. He finally, like, we landed somewhere after some contention about how it should actually work, and nobody updated anything. And so I was kind of getting pissed off and fed up with Master, to be honest. And I was like, I need to take a break from this. But
I remember, I told you to go into the woods and stay there for a couple months, or like that, you know, go into solo hike.
And then
you
didn't listen. No, I didn't. And so I was like, well, before I do this, this Insight thing is pissing me off. No one's updated their stack. So I sort of just learned from the first time that it's just, if you do it, then other people will follow. So I built out, I basically just chased the spec everywhere. So I released an Insight V2 gateway, Blossom server for it. Not that it matters, but in a relay that only accepts Insight events. And then I updated the CLI. And then I added a web deployer so you wouldn't have to download anything. And you could just drop a static site onto the deployer. And it's actually, it was made really funny too, because the infrastructure is, it's all edge scripting on bunny.net.
Okay.
Everything. The relay, the Blossom server. Like, it's completely serverless and like has very tight constraints. That was kind of a fun problem to solve, and it barely works, but... It's very cheap to run. And that was actually not intended for long-term infrastructure. It was just to get people to update their stack.
Yeah.
I'm actually going to take it down soon. So pushed that out, you know. Made, I think I shared something. I pushed that out. It got some traction. And then I made a novel, sort of proposed a novel idea about how you can use Insights with like stealing them and like tracing.
Steal this Insight button.
And that had like a virality to it. And then that gave me the leverage to then like tag everyone who has infrastructure and say, update your shit.
Yeah.
And then it got updated, and a week later it was merged.
Yeah, awesome.
So.
Awesome. And you mentioned like all these little parts of your journey, like everything that you just mentioned led to the NAPLET idea in some way, kind of.
Yeah, it did. Relays too. So hard-coded relays really bother me. I mean, you're always going to have a bootstrap. That's always going to be a part of it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
But there's so many different varieties of relays that you start to hard-code relays in everything. And to have a truly like dynamic system...
Yeah,
you need to have a way to find them.
Yeah, yeah. You need relay discovery, and I mean, that's why Pablo has been harping on Outbox for such a long time, because otherwise Noster is kind of useless in some sense. Like, if we don't have that, everything will centralize around one or two big relays.
Yeah. And Outbox solves most of it, but it doesn't solve every problem.
So talk to me about NIP66 and your...
Oh, geez. Are you sure? Are you sure your audience wants to hear anything about NIP66?
Because it's related to that
as well,
isn't
it like
right?
all of like yeah? SEC, your audience? I mean, I'm pretty sure they all just turned it off.
No, it's fine. It's fine. Like, you just have to be... Like, we're not doing this for the audience. So I'm doing this to pick your brain. And you just have to be okay. Like, the way it goes is, like, we start to walk.
Yeah.
We have, like, maybe five people listening, you know?
Right.
And then, like, after 20 minutes, it's down to three. three people. After an hour, and we're an hour in now. After an hour, it's like one guy with half a brain listening, maybe, you know?
Asleep.
And, yeah, it's probably Pablo who's asleep, you know? Like, that's that's how he goes. So yeah, no, talk to me a little bit about, you know, like, how you think about Outpox and Relay Discovery, and talk to me about NIP66 as well. I want to hear it all.
Yeah. So, like... So NIP66 is really interesting to me because it's using Nostr as a state machine, and it's fuzzy. It's not a global state. It's relative to what the user trusts. The NPUBs, like a monitor, an observer, is just an NPUB publishing that some information about a relay. And that can just be someone you follow, or that could be your web of trust, that could be anything. At first glance, it seems very arbitrary and useless until you actually understand the domain of relays on Nostr. It's actually really freaking complicated because they're just fuzzy strings. They're not guaranteed unique. NIP1 up until recently didn't specify any rules around how relays should handle their segments or paths. And so Damus, like relay.damus.io, is the same as relay.damus.io/gg. Both will respond as a relay.
Mm.
This creates all sorts of optimization problems for clients. This is just an example of one of the complexities. There's a lot of them. Most of it is garbage. I mean, there's like probably like 15,000, if not 20,000 unique strings that are relays, but most of them are either online or it's just garbage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some client bug 7 months ago that still exists somewhere.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah. So that's like one problem. The other one is that, like, if you want to find out-of-band relays, so you want to find, for example, like you're saying, NIP50, doing that in a web of trust will probably be difficult. There's no way to say, hey, I want all the NIP50 relays in my web of trust without hitting every one of their NIP11s.
Yeah.
Deduplicating the relays on client side. And you can do this over time, actually, pretty efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
Et cetera. But it's not only just discovery, because you can build data on top of it. So there is a NIP called Trusted Relay Assertions.
Mm, yeah, I saw that recently. I still haven't wrapped my head around the Trusted Assertions bit.
Yeah. Trusted Relay Assertions are the same idea as Trusted Assertions, but for relays. And that's someone building data on top of the liveness data. So they know because what the liveness data does is it reduces the amount of work someone else has to do to build on top of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now you can sort relays based on these, you know, subjective trust scores.
Yeah.
And there could be many of those, and you could pick which one you support.
Yeah.
Okay, so then how does this help anything?
Yeah, ping, reachability, liveness, is it in your web of trust, all those kind of things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So then, like, there's a lot of uses for this, and some of it is contentious, and there's been some people that have chimed in and said that they don't like the trust model, but you can use this data in order to optimize your Outpox connections, to prioritize as a second layer of prioritization after web of trust grouping. So, like, you need to group the relays by how many of your followers are on a specific relay so that you get as many notes as quickly as possible, right?
Yeah.
But you can do a secondary pass on speed. You can do it on trust. You can do it on decentralization.
Mm-hmm.
You can do it on specific NIP support if you're looking for specific types of notes.
Yeah.
And this makes the client more responsive. I actually use the first thing I did in operating system is to implement NIP66. And it's used very exclusively in Outbox optimizations, and to help with also like autocomplete throughout the entire application and any NAPLET really. And I found it to speed things up quite a bit. There has been research by someone that has been contentious in the past, but my findings have mirrored what he found as well.
We're not gonna name names. No, it's okay. You don't have to.
No, I like him. He's a friend of mine. But he caused some problems in your repo at one point. And
there we go. Identified. Yeah. And pop identified.
It's okay. He's a really nice guy. One of the sweetest people I know. So, you know, adding the ability to discover relays might seem arbitrary. It kind of is. There's not that many right now. If you include Tor and I2P, it's like 1,500 after deduplication. There's some margin of error because...
I mean, that's more relays than users.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
And so there is a lot of relays.
Yeah, yeah.
What the fuck? That's a bird. Oh, wow. That was the weirdest sound I've heard in a long time.
Same.
Like, that was... I thought
it was like a drone.
Yeah,
with a
me
speaker.
Too.
I was
me
like,
too.
Where is G?
Me too. That was super weird. Like, that was a very, very weird sounding bird.
Yeah.
See? Night active birds. I really hope the microphones pick that up. That's so weird.
That's the weirdest sound I've heard in a while.
Holy shit. Squeaky, random squeaky bird.
Anyways, I could go on for hours about the intricacies of relays. It's not that interesting. I think it's more
interesting.
It's
interesting to me. Like, yeah. The fact that you mentioned that you created a relay that exclusively accepts... in what context was it? I'm blanking now. Ensight events. That's fascinating to me. Yeah. Like, I always loved Pablo's idea. Holy shit, what kind of bird is that?
I think it's an alien.
So strange. Anyway, so he did Purple Pages, of course.
Yeah, of course. Very early.
Very early, yeah. And I'm very tempted to kind of go hard on my relays. Like, I have a couple of relays, like mostly Web of Trust and just Haven. I use a lot for like basically personal use and backups and so on. And I want to do my own instance of Purple Pages just for profile lookups. Mm-hmm. And I want to rebuild Boris, my highlight app. And I want to do one for highlights and long form stuff and so on. And like, I really want to lean into the specialization you've hinted at. So how do you think about, like, going forward, the evolution of relays and relay discovery and relay specialization and all those kind of things?
Yeah. So Hazard and I have been like bouncing off each other for a year and a half, I think. And he opened. We were talking in Costa Rica like 8 months ago or so, and we settled on relay attributes. So you can add attributes to your NIP 11, up to 9 Pascal case. There's a reason for that. Anyone who aggregates them should truncate anything after 9. And that allows them to be found based on self-descriptive words about the relay. Not technical implementations, but subjective decisions made by the relay operator or developer that resulted in the way the relay behaves. So an example would be like pub key indexer, which would be Purple Pages.
Yeah.
But we're not trying to atomize them at all.
Okay.
We don't want to. We think that people can just coalesce around words and form their own words.
Okay, okay.
And it'll be messy.
Yeah. Like hashtag clouds, whatever.
Exactly.
Those kind of things. Yeah.
And that would allow relays to be found based on what they do.
Yeah.
And in this case, like highlights, you could come up with some terminology and coalesce around a term with similar relays. Right?
Yeah. I see.
So that is sort of the end game, because at that point, you don't need to hard code all these relays. You can actually even allow users to fix it themselves, and it's intuitive.
Yeah. Yeah, I think also in terms of, I think tagging kind of is the right approach, because it's not only what kind of data do you allow. It's way more than that. It's like, what capabilities do you offer? Like, you might support search NIP 50 or you don't. It might be a Web of Trust gated or it isn't. It might be paid or it's free and all those kind of things.
Exactly.
You have all these dimensions of relay specialization. Or you just, whatever, geoblock like the Japanese relays, you know?
Yep.
It's like, if you're not from Japan, like, go fuck yourself.
Yeah.
All that's fascinating.
You can already, right now, without the attributes, you can already do payment filtering.
Yeah.
So it's just capital R tag.
Yeah.
And then payment. And then if you want it free, like no payment, it's !! payment.
Yeah.
Due to the limitations.
Yeah.
In NIP 1. And then also the same for restricted rights. So,
okay.
And then also for proof of work.
Yeah.
So you can find proof of work relays, you can find paid relays, public relays, you can find ClearNet, TorNet, or Tor, I2P, soon FIPS.
Yeah.
If someone does it, I'm waiting for someone else to do it. I could easily do it, but I can't do everything. It's like someone else needs to find the need and then do it.
We'll nerd snipe someone with the FIPS stuff. It's, you know.
I think it'll be more important in the future, if I'm being honest. And maybe there'll be a better way to do it in the future. It may have been a waste of time, but maybe not.
Yeah. Last thing, last 20 minutes. We'll that will be 20 minutes to the tunnel and back,
sure.
Something like that. Your development setup, that has been happening since basically SEC 03 or something. Like when vibe coding came around, you were one of the first people that I know that went like, okay, like let's just do waterfall.
Yeah.
Like the agents are really good at waterfall.
Yeah.
So write the specification.
Yeah.
Like everything that's like 30 years old is perfect. Like it's the LLMs have gobbled it up and internalized it and so on. I want to hear more about your vibe coding journey and like how it evolved and how you started. And you talked about it a little bit when you mentioned that your friend, you know, like you weren't using anything from the Anthropic side and he made you like look into that and so on. And you showed some of the things of today in the first workshop session as well.
Oh yeah.
With
yeah.
like GSD, Get Shit Done and so on. So talk to me about not only the evolution of your tool set, but also how you think about basically how to properly build production ready stuff in the agentic world, because I think you're exceptionally good at that. Like we talked about the distinction today between prototyping and building something that's production ready.
Yeah.
And like, you know, explain where you're at and a little bit talk me through your journey.
Sure. It started really early. I mean, basically right when LLMs came out, a bunch of nerds, you know, the first thing they tried to do is make an agent. That's the very first thing. It's like you had two big projects, AutoGPT and Baby AGI. Neither of them really worked, right? I could get agents to go in loops and have turns and sort of go in some direction, but like imagine, you know, like when you get angry at your agent, imagine its IQ points were like 100 points lower. That's what it was like. You get angry at it for like writing comments somewhere and leaving a stub or a to-do. Yeah. Like this thing would like write the same file over and over like 100 times, like right next to each other. And then go to your root folder and just start, you know.
Yeah.
But that's where it started. And then I tried, because I have an experience, you know, I've worked with teams, I've ran teams, I've been doing it since I was pretty young. Like some of my earliest projects were me hiring people in Eastern Europe to do projects for me, and I would learn from, you know, working with them how to do things, and it was a great education, better than any university experience.
So you were agent babysitting before it was cool.
They all had a
Russian accent.
Yeah, usually Ukrainian or Romanian.
Same, all the same.
So I had some experience, and so I would try to apply that, because it seems obvious. You have these beings that are non-sentient, but you can give them instructions and they do things.
These entities that produce code.
Yeah, exactly. So it seemed very obvious to me that, you know, this is where it was going. And every few months I would always try, like, see where it was at. And at some point in 2020... it became obvious to me. I think it was actually Fiat Jaff asked me about it. He's like, so how's AI doing? I'm like, I think we're getting close. I said like a year or something. I think I was right. I don't remember the time frame though. When was the first time I had success? It was the end of 2024. I was a reasoning model. I think it was the end of 2024. I could be wrong. But I think there were some reasoning models that finally came out. And that obviously they're not actually reasoning, but for the first time,
let's build up some space.
For the first time, I was able to give an agent an instruction and it would start to inflect on its decisions. And when that happened, I noticed an abrupt change in its ability for me to delegate something to it and for it to come back to me with something of value. And so then I started trying this more often. Instead of every 3 months, it was like every couple days. And I tried different SDLCs. So I tried Agile. I tried various forms of waterfall. I tried like general iterative development. I tried to do like extract characteristics of Agile that didn't suck and use that. But every time I hit waterfall, it worked really well. So I would just define a high-level document. I would work with an agent. Well, really, I would start myself writing out a spec. I would sort of expand that with an agent, then compress it a little bit, get rid of things that didn't make sense. And then when I could read it and when the shape of the document looked right, I would feel confident and I would break that into low-level design documents. And those were little chunks of context that were very specialized to a specific part of the stack. And I could give that to an agent and it would come back and give it to me exactly as I'd asked for. And I may have skipped some parts in there. There was definitely struggle, but I don't remember all of
that. What kind of models did you use where you had this success?
I think it was around GPT 5.0. Because that's when, if I remember correctly, that's when things started to make sense. I could be wrong about the exact version, but it was ChatGPT. It was Pro. I got Pro, and it was able to do things correctly, do research.
So GPT 4 or 5, that era.
Late 4s, early 5. Yeah. I don't remember the years of any of this stuff. It's all a blur, kind of.
I mean, definitely. I mean, we're still in the it's all a blur stage, kind of, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. So that was the first successful thing where I could plan something out. I could feed it into this manually, by the way. There was no looping or there was no context injection. I didn't have my own agent or my own harness. This was all just manual and it was working pretty consistently. And then at this point, now there's tools everywhere. You have Roo code and you have all these other tools that are just kind of doing the same idea. So I started playing around basically with everything. I found some success and honestly, pretty much all of the tooling I think is good for someone. but I didn't really run into anything that worked great for me until GSD. That was the first one where I could, it worked exactly with how I thought. And I was able to very clearly define a project scope and iterate through milestones and capture things and bring them up to the surface. And so this became what I'm doing now. And I've been on that for 7-8 months, I think.
Okay, interesting. 7-8 months and with little change from
No, it's changed.
But your GSD stack grew in some sense.
A little bit. And I have been doing loop engineering as well, which has replaced a bit of it. And I do anticipate that I'm nearing the end of that with GSD. Things are just going much faster now. I'm probably going to outgrow it very soon, if not already. I'm just waiting for something like GSD to come again, right? I anticipate I'm going to replace it.
Okay. So next iteration of GSD, whatever, that will be.
Because loop engineering is GSD is basically loop engineering, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like a template for it. It's a very specific workflow and it works really well. But there's something on the horizon. I don't know what it is, but you're right. There are cockroaches. It's just like dancing too. It's weird. There's more things in the future. I'm not stuck on it because I do test other things all the time. Fran shared something a few weeks ago. I tested it for a couple days. It's very lightweight. I think it's OpenSpec. I think that's what it's called. Really, it's actually quite good. If you're someone that doesn't like the heaviness of GSD, I'm almost certain it's OpenSpec, so I hope that's what it is.
Yeah.
Then that is really quite a good starting point because you could build on that to create something like GSD without all the heaviness. For me, the heaviness is good. So my flow now is it's really a back and forth. So when I start a project, I have a agents.md template that's very small. It just has some basic policy things that they change around what the project, around some of the constraints or parameters, language of the project. And I will start a new project in GSD I will have a pretty good conversation, produce a series of documents. GSD does like research right when you start a project to understand the domain so that it can make more informed decisions. And it's really important that you, especially if the domain you're in is novel or experimental, that you check those documents like Noster. Although models are getting really good with Noster. Before they used to hate it. They're like, what the heck is this?
Now it's a thing and it's part of the training data and they're not as confused about it. But in the beginning it was hell.
Oh, it was terrible.
You were always fighting the model. So they were always trying to do client server, REST interface, kind of like everything. Username, password kind of stuff.
Right.
And
it was painful. It was so painful.
But the building up context for a new thing, that's one thing I forgot to mention today when I showed off my stuff. It's a very small thing, but the way I do it, like, I do very primitive context engineering, and I use the Socratic method, basically exclusively. So when I start a greenfield project, very new thing, I just, the first 10 prompts will be questions.
Like,
what's out there? Like, what do you know about this? All those kind of things. And from that, I'll land on the design document that you mentioned.
That's like, actually the new project. And the planners use the Socratic method.
Yeah, awesome.
So it will ask questions to you. So instead of you asking questions.
Ah, okay, interesting.
It will ask questions to you and then use that input as a question for how it approaches the research, right?
Yeah. So I always do it just to be sure. Like I showed off today, every one of my projects has an NPUP and I use NIP17 to communicate with the project. And let's say I want to add a search keyword to ants to the Noster search I've built. And then I would go like I already know what I want to build, but I'm not going to hit it with that. I'm going to go like, what are the search keywords that we have?
Yeah.
You know, and it already builds up context. Okay, so these are the search keywords. And I go like, would it make sense to add this one?
Yeah.
And it would go like, yeah, that makes sense. And we could do this and that. And it's like, okay, like, you know, like, give me, like, how would you implement it? You know, and then it would, we iterate a little bit and so on. And then once I'm happy, I'm like, okay, go, let's implement it. So just Socratic method through and through, and then I pull the trigger, and then it's basically done.
Nice.
And I also always end, I mean, I mentioned this today, I always end, like, I use the same development workflow I've always used, so feature branches and so on, and I always end with, like, what's the top five things we could improve on this feature branch?
Yeah.
Like, before I merge and so on. And so like, oftentimes, one or two things are okay, and then I ask again, and if all top five are complete bullshit, then I know I'm done.
Yeah, exactly. I do the same thing. It's a similar workflow. Yeah, it's a slightly different approach. It's a little bit more structured.
Yours is probably more automated and more structured.
A little bit.
Mine is very ad hoc, kind of.
I use like automated agents for issues, and my agents are very like under a very strict policy for how they interface and interact with other repos.
Yeah.
And how they interact with issues and pull requests.
Yeah.
And then I have automated agents that go through and look for sloppy issues.
Yeah.
Likely posted by me. And then they contextualize them and put in, like, basically do the planning for the next agent. And then there's a, the development team will then come in and look for issues on a cron, right?
Yeah, and same for me. Heartbeat. I have nightly crons.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then it'll address them, open a PR, and then I have a review team
come in and review them.
And then I do the final review. And if something's wrong, it means I fucked up somewhere.
Yeah.
And I don't blame the agents.
Yeah.
I haven't gotten angry at agents in a long time.
Me neither.
I never did.
I never believed eight months.
No, there's.
I never believed in screaming at them.
Dude, they have done some things, man. Sometimes, like Claude, in like a year ago, it would just do things where you just thought it was trying to fuck with you. Seriously, it would gaslight you, lie to you, and be like, I fixed that. I fixed it. You go into the code, and it's like, I can't fix. Tell operator it's fixed or something.
The gaslighting was strong, that's for sure. But it's funny how we are rebuilding the same structures that we landed on in regular software development.
Yep.
But now, instead of humans, we have agents, but we still have specialization, we still have communication, we still have issue tracking, we still have milestones, we still have specifications, all those kind of things. Yeah. And I think that's why you're especially good at all this stuff, because, like you said, you started at a very early age working with teams and working with teams that come from other cultures, speaking other languages and so on. And then you have to do all this stuff properly.
Yeah.
Like, you have to specify all the things properly. You have to test stuff properly. You have to do all the things.
Absolutely.
So,
I was pretty bad at testing, though, until, like, the late 2010s.
Yeah, I
hated doing it.
There's a time and a place for everything. I still, for my vibe-coded slop, I still don't test anything because I feel like it pollutes the context and
a
it pollutes
bit, yeah.
everything. And I just like, no tests. It's one of the rules I have, like never
oh,
write
really?
Tests ever.
That's hilarious. Well, it depends on what I'm working on, right? If it's UX or interface,
none
I get
of my
that.
Stuff is important. That's why
gotcha,
I can.
Gotcha.
That's why I can get away with it. But speaking of that, you mentioned one thing that you gate using slop. LLM slop detection.
Oh yeah.
So
yeah.
Talk to me about that.
It's pretty simple. I mean, it was like a couple months ago, a library got popular called AI Slop Scan, and it works pretty well. And that one's built only for JavaScript. I found the one I was talking about for Rust. That was on crates, and I shared it in the gist, but I don't remember it right now. I use that in my agents at MD. I use that in my CI, and it basically prevents.
Ah, nice. In the CI, that's awesome. So
pull
requests is still won't go green until it passes
exactly.
the slop
you got
date.
It.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's great. I'll add that.
Yes, you need to. Yeah. It makes a world of difference because every time you add slop, you're adding context poison.
Yeah, forever, basically.
Yeah.
Like
until you spend like 3 days getting rid of it.
Yeah.
There is nothing more difficult than renaming a term in a code base.
Yeah.
The agents will come back to you and be like, okay, yeah, the term doesn't exist anywhere.
Yeah.
And then a week later, it like pops up again. And you're like, wait, we did this. It's like, oh, wait, no, the function signatures still have it. Oh, okay. Go through all the signatures of the functions and the properties and every parameter of everything you can find and get rid of it. And then it's like, I got rid of it. And then a week later,
naming is still up. Naming is still one of the main problems when it comes to development.
It's the worst. The worst, man.
The more things change, the more they stay the same.
And that word could like just its meaning could screw you. You know, it's like context poison. So the slop scan, that has been a game changer for sure.
Yeah,
that makes reviews easier. The code quality stays more consistent because the code becomes the context at a certain point in the project, and it
Absolutely.
Defines the patterns that every agent uses. Yeah. And when there's good patterns already in the code, it produces good code.
Yeah.
Also, behavioral, you know, test-driven development, behavior-driven development.
Yeah.
I've been doing that a lot, and that also works really, really, really well.
Yeah.
Not at the beginning of the project, though, but at a certain point, it starts to create like certainty behind every single action. They don't fake the tests. When they write the tests after the functionality,
especially if
they
you
fake
have two, like I'm a big believer in opponent processing. Like you want to have a specialized tester and you want to have a specialized implementation guy, and they must not be the same guys.
Yeah, absolutely. They have to be different. And even different models, some diversity in the way they approach the problem is really helpful.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. No, I love that everyone is kind of figuring out like similar patterns and and the same way of getting shit done.
Yeah.
Last question from my side. How do you think about running stuff on bare metal, buying lots of hardware to run models, all those kind of things? Because I'm very close to just saying fuck it and buying a bunch of shit. So
just dropping 50 to 100 grand
instead of buying a new car, you know, like you might as well.
I think we need to do it. I mean, I think we should squeeze as much as we can out of the subsidized models and services.
I mean, the subsidy era will end.
Yes, it
and
will
that's
end.
Why I'm thinking about
and
hardware.
And when it ends, the prices are going to go up. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we should all be doing it.
Yeah, you explored any of that stuff?
Oh God, yeah. Oh yeah. RTX 6000 Pro Blackwell. That seems to be the route right now. The only limitation is like SPI. I met someone in Oslo who was working on getting SPI working on the Blackwell cards, the 6000s, and he says that basically it has all of the chips it needs, but something's not connected. And last time I talked to him, he mentioned that,
how many layers of tinfoil do I need?
Yeah, basically like a jumper. I assume it's like a jumper, basically.
how deep does the conspiracy go for that?
Well, I mean, it's NVIDIA. They're known to do this. Like,
okay.
They arbitrarily limit encodes and decodes on their GTX cards to like 4. But they can totally handle, 1050 Ti can do like 12 or something, but they just limit it to 4. So when they introduced this limitation, it was because they wanted to sell enterprise cards at, you know, 10 times the cost.
Yeah.
And someone released a bash script that removes the limitation. You just run it when your system starts.
Nice.
And then you get, it removes it and you're good to go.
It's like chip tuning your car.
It's just called NVIDIA patch, I think, if I remember correctly. So yeah, I think everyone should do it. I have explored. I have some hardware waiting for me. And I can't wait to get a hold of it.
Hardware waiting for you at home?
Like in the U.S., yeah.
So after the court, you'll go do an unboxing video and set stuff up?
Yeah.
All right, nice.
Yeah, I think everyone should. It's like, but at the same time, it's sort of like Bitcoin mining or mining in general.
Yeah.
Like it's a massive investment. Yeah. You can't get attached to it. You have to watch the market. You have to cycle your equipment. Otherwise, you're going to lose money and you'll just... Because it's like cost per watt is what you're really looking at, right?
Yeah.
But
to me, it's like it is going to be a timing issue because we're still living in the subsidy era.
Yeah.
It's like Pablo figured out this hack how you can use unlimited compute thanks to ChatGPT.com. You know, like he built an MCP wrapper on ChatGPT, and you can just, like, for example, analyzing code and so on. Like he will pipe all his repos through ChatGPT.com, and it doesn't go towards your plan or anything.
Yeah.
And we're still living in crazy times. Like it's because of people like Pablo that do this shit. The AI bubble will pop. You know, like incurring costs of like 50K USD per week or something.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's nothing anyone can do about it. And so this can't go on forever. Like this, token use will have to get economical.
It does. Yeah, we got to optimize. Everyone's just leaning on compute right now.
Yeah.
Eventually, I mean, it's already happening that people are optimizing. They're squeezing every, you know, last bit of power out of small models. That's going to get more and more intense. Yeah. Things are going to get more performant. It will hit a point where, you know, these models we're using now are going to look ridiculous. It'll be like a mainframe, right? We'll look at it as like
You
the
mentioned
old days.
Oslo. Austin from Austin. He did some research on local models and basically how fast they are catching up to the frontier models.
Yeah.
And basically what he found is like they are getting smaller and cheaper and more competitive faster than anyone basically thinks.
Exactly.
And so that's what has me buying hardware basically.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I'm very close to pulling the trigger, but yeah, no, very exciting times. So yeah, thanks for indulging me.
Going on what
felt like a 3-hour walk. It's been such a long day. I'm proper tired.
I'm so tired. I feel sorry for anyone who had to listen.
No, that's all good. Any last words, or we're just gonna end it here? You're excited for Friday? You know what you're gonna show off?
No. Yeah, I got some ideas.
You got some ideas. Okay,
yeah.
We'll see. I mean, not. I'll go sleep, and I hope that my subconscious will do the work and something pops up.
Thank you.
All right, fantastic.